Back in the kitchen, Toby pours the rest of the boiled water into a bowl. She needs to clean away those bedraggled feathers and sequins. She carries the bowl and a pair of scissors and a bar of soap and a stack of pink washcloths into Ren's cubicle, folds back the sheet, and cuts away the grubby outfit. It isn't cloth, it's some other substance underneath the feathers. Stretchy, almost like skin. She soaks the patches where it's stuck on so she can peel them off more easily. The crotch has been torn away. Cripes, thinks Toby. What a mess. Later, she'll make a poultice. There are abrasions around the neck. Rope burns, no doubt. The gash on the left leg is what's festering. Toby's as gentle as she can be, but Ren winces and yelps. That fucking hurts, she says. Then she throws up the salt and sugar water. After she's wiped away the filth, Toby starts washing the leg wound. How did you get this? She asks.
I don't know, Ren is whispering. I fell down.
Toby cleans out the gash and puts some honey on it. Antibiotics in it, Pilar used to say. There ought to be a first aid kit somewhere in the spa.
Hold still. You don't want gangrene, she says to Ren.
Ren giggles.
Knock, knock, she says. Gangrene.
The dirty covering's all stripped away, and Ren has been sponged. I'll give you some willow and chamomile, Toby says. And Poppy, she thinks. You need to sleep. Ren will be safer on the floor than on the table. She makes a nest of pink towels, eases her down onto it, adds extra padding because Ren can't make it to the bathroom. She's too weak. She's hot as an ember. Toby brings the willow mixture in a small glass. Ren swallows, her throat moving like a bird's. Nothing comes up. There's no use trying the maggots yet. Ren needs to be coherent for that, able to obey instructions. No scratching, for instance. The first thing is to get the temperature down. While Ren sleeps, Toby sorts through her store of dried mushrooms. She chooses the immune system boosters.
Rushi, Metaki, Shiitake, Birch Polypore, Zhuling, Lion's Mane, Cordyceps, Iceman.
She puts them in boiled water to soak. Then in the afternoon, she prepares a mushroom elixir. The simmering, the straining, the cooling, and gives Ren 30 drops of it. The cubicle stinks. Toby lifts Ren up, rolls her to the side, pulls out the soiled towels, wipes Ren off. She's put on rubber gloves for the purpose. If dysentery's going around, she has no wish to catch it. She smooths down clean towels, rolls Ren back. Her arms flop. Her head wilts. She's muttering. This is going to be a lot of work, thinks Toby. And when Ren recovers, if she recovers, there will be two people eating instead of one. So the food stash will be gone twice as quickly, what's left of it, which isn't much. Maybe the fever will get the better of Ren. Maybe she'll die in her sleep. Toby considers the powdered death angels. It wouldn't take much. Just a little, in Ren's weakened condition. Put her out of her misery. Help her to fly away on white, white wings. Maybe it would be kinder, a blessing. I am an unworthy person, Toby thinks, merely to have such an idea. You've known this girl since she was a child. She's come to you for help. She has every right to trust you. Adam One would say that Ren is a precious gift that has been given to Toby so that Toby may demonstrate unselfishness and sharing and those higher qualities the gardeners had been so eager to bring out in her. Toby can't quite see it that way. Not at the moment. But she'll have to keep trying. Ren sighs and groans and flails. She's having a bad dream. When it's dark, Toby lights a candle and sits beside her, listening to her breathe. In, out. In, out. Pause. In, then out. Raggedy. At intervals, she feels Ren's forehead. Cooler? There must be a thermometer in the building. In the morning, she'll look for it. She takes her pulse, rapid, irregular. Then she nods off in her chair. And the next thing she knows, she wakes up in the dark with a smell of singeing. She winds up her flashlight. The candle has fallen over, and a corner of Ren's pink sheet is smoldering. Luckily, it's damp. That was terminally stupid, Toby tells herself. No more candles, unless I'm fully awake. Chapter 65. Toby, St. Mahatma Gandhi Day. Year 25. In the morning, Ren feels cooler. Her pulse is stronger, and she can even hold the cup of warm water in her own two trembling hands. Toby's put mint in it this morning, as well as the honey and salt. Once Ren has gone to sleep again, Toby hauls the dirty sheets and towels up to the roof to wash them. She's brought her binoculars, and while the sheets and towels are soaking, she scans the spa grounds. Pigs far away, over in the southwest corner of the meadow. Two mohairs, a blue one and a silver one, grazing quietly together. No liobams. Dogs barking somewhere. Vultures flapping around the pig funeral site. Get away from there, you archaeologists, says Toby. She's feeling lightheaded, almost giddy, in the mood to tell herself jokes. Three huge pink butterflies circle her head, alight on the damp sheets. Maybe they think they've found the biggest pink butterfly of all. Maybe it's a love affair. Now they have their thin tongues unrolled, licking. Not love, then, salt. Some will tell you love is merely chemical, my friends, said Adam One. Of course it is chemical. Where would any of us be without chemistry? But science is merely one way of describing the world. Another way of describing it would be to say, where would any of us be without love? Dear Adam One, thinks Toby. He must be dead. And Zeb, dead also, despite wishful thinking. Though maybe not, because if I'm alive, more to the point, if Ren's alive, then anyone at all could be alive too. She stopped listening on her wind-up radio months ago because the silence was so discouraging. But just because she's heard no one doesn't mean no one's there. Which had been among Adam One's hypothetical proofs for the existence of God. Toby washes Ren's infected leg, applies more honey. Ren eats a little, drinks a little. More mushroom elixir, more willow. After much rummaging, Toby locates a spa first aid kit. There's a tube of antibiotic cream, but it's stale dated. No thermometer. Who ordered this crap, she thinks. Oh yes, I did. Anyway, maggots are better. In the afternoon, she lifts the maggots from the plastic snap top, rinses them in tepid water. Then she transfers them to a sheet of gauze from the first aid kit, applies another sheet over the top, and tapes the maggot-filled envelope over the wound. It won't take long for the maggots to eat through the gauze. They know what they like. This will tickle, she tells Ren, but they'll make you better. Try not to move your leg.
What are they? Says Ren.
They're your friends, says Toby, but you don't need to look. Her homicidal impulse of the night before is gone. She will not drag dead Ren out into the meadow for the pigs and vultures. Now she'd like to cure her, cherish her, for isn't it miraculous that Ren is here? That she's come through the waterless flood with only minor damage, or fairly minor. Just to have a second person on the premises, even a feeble person, even a sick person who sleeps most of the time. Just this makes the spa seem like a cozy domestic dwelling rather than a haunted house. I've been the ghost, thinks Toby. Chapter 66. Toby. Saint Henri Fabre. Saint Anna Atkins. St. Tim Flannery, St. Ichita-san, St. David Suzuki, St. Peter Matheson. Year 25. It takes the maggots 3 days to clean the wound. Toby watches them carefully. If they run out of dead tissue, they'll start in on living flesh. By the second morning, Ren's fever has gone, though Toby continues the mushroom drops just to make sure. Ren's eating more now. Toby helps her up the stairs to the roof and sits her down on the imitation wood bench in the early morning light. The maggots are photophobic. Light drives them into the deepest corners of the wound, which is where they need to be. No movement out there in the meadow. No sounds from the forest. Toby tries asking Ren where she's been ever since the flood hit, and how she escaped it, and how she got here, why she'd been dressed in those blue feathers. But she only tries once, because Ren starts crying. All she'll say is, "I've lost Amanda." "Never mind," says Toby, "we'll find her." On the fourth morning, Toby removes the maggot plaster. The wound is clean and healing. "Now to get your muscles back in shape," she tells Ren. Ren starts walking up and down the stairs, along the corridors. She's gained a little weight. Toby's been feeding her the last few jars of Anuyu lemon meringue facial, which has a lot of sugar in it and nothing toxic that Toby can think of. She leads Ren through some exercises from Zeb's old urban bloodshed limitation classes, the Satsuma, the Unagi. Centered like a fruit, sinuous like an eel. She needs the refresher herself. She's out of practice. After a few days, Ren tells her story, or a little of her story. It comes out in short clumps of words, punctuated by long periods of staring into space. She tells about being locked in at Scales and how Amanda came all the way from the Wisconsin desert and figured out the door code. Then Shacky and Croge and Oates appeared from nowhere just like magic, and she was so happy. They'd been saved by being in Painball when the plague broke out. But then, three horrible men from the Painball Gold Team came to Scales, and she and Amanda and the boys ran away. She'd said they should come to Anuyu because Toby might be there, and they'd almost made it. They were walking along through the trees, and then blackout. She can't get any farther than that. "What did they look like?" says Toby. "Did they have any..." She wants to say distinguishing marks, but Ren shakes her head, meaning that the subject is closed. "I have to find Amanda," she says, wiping away tears. "I really have to. They'll kill her." "Here, blow your nose," says Toby, handing her a pink washcloth. "Amanda's very clever. It's best to talk as if Amanda is still alive. She's very resourceful. She'll be all right." She's about to say that women are in short supply, and therefore Amanda will surely be preserved and rationed, but she thinks better of it.
"You don't understand," says Ren, crying harder. "There's three of them. They're Painball. They're not really human. I have to find her."
"We'll look," Toby says to be soothing. "But we don't know where she's gone."
"Where would you go," says Ren, "if you were them?"
"Maybe east," says Toby, "to the sea where they could fish."
"We can go there."
"When you're strong enough," says Toby. They have to move somewhere else anyway. The food supply's shrinking fast.
"I'm strong enough now," says Ren.
Toby scours the garden, unearths one more lone onion. She digs up three burdocks from the near edge of the meadow and some Queen Anne's lace, the spindly white proto-carrot roots.
"Do you think you could eat a rabbit?" she asks Ren, "if I cut it up very small and make it into soup?"
"I guess so," said Ren. "I'll try."
Toby's almost ready for the switch to full-blown carnivore herself. There's the sound of the rifle shot to worry about, but if there are still painballers lurking in the forest, they already know she has a gun. No harm in reminding them. There are often green rabbits near the swimming pool. Toby shoots at one of them from the rooftop, but she can't seem to hit it. Is conscience twisting her aim? Maybe she needs a bigger target, a deer or a dog. She hasn't seen the pigs lately or any of the sheep. Just as she was getting all set to eat them, they're gone. She locates the pack sacks on a laundry room shelf. She hasn't been down there since the pump stopped working, and the air is thick with mildew. Luckily, the pack sacks aren't cotton, but impenetrable synthetic. She takes them up to the roof, sponges them off, leaves them in the hot sun to dry. She lays out her available supplies on the kitchen counter.
Don't carry so much weight that you burn more calories than you can eat, says the voice of Zeb. Tools are more important than food. Your best tool is your brain.
The rifle, of course, ammunition, trowel for digging roots, matches, barbecue lighter, which won't last long, but it might as well be used up, pocket knife with scissors and tweezers, rope, 2 sheets of plastic, handy in rain, wind-up flashlight, gauze bandages, duct tape, plastic snap-top containers, cloth bags for wild edibles, cooking pot, the Kelly kettle, toilet paper, a luxury item but she can't resist, 2 medium-sized Zizzy fruits from a spa mini bar, raspberry flavor, junk food but food since it has calories in it. The bottles can be used later for water. Spoons, metal, 2. Cups, plastic, 2. The remaining sunblock, the last super debug spray. Binoculars, heavy but necessary. The mop handle. Sugar, salt, the last of the honey, the last jolt bars, the last soy bits. The syrup of poppy, the dried mushrooms, the death angels. The day before they leave, she cuts her hair short. It's a shorn look. It reminds her of Joan of Arc on a bad day, but she doesn't want a hair handle growing out of her head, all the better to grab you by and slash your throat. She cuts Ren's hair as well. They'll be cooler that way, she tells her.
We should bury the hair, says Ren.
She wants it out of sight for some reason Toby can't fathom.
Why don't we put it on the roof, says Toby, that way the birds can make nests out of it.
She doesn't intend to waste her body's calories digging a hair burial site.
Oh, okay, says Ren.
This idea seems to please her. Chapter 67. Toby, St. Chico Mendez, Martyr. Year 25. They leave the spa building just before dawn. They're dressed in pink cotton exercise outfits, the loose pants and the t-shirt top with the kissy mouth and the winky eye on the front. Pink canvas sport shoes, of the kind the ladies wore to do their rope skipping and weight training. Broad pink hats. They smell of Super D and of rancid Solar Nicks. In their pack sacks are their pink top-to-toes for when the sun gets too high. If only everything weren't so pink, thinks Toby, like baby clothes or girly birthday parties. Not an adventurous color. Terrible choice for camouflage. She knows the situation is grave, as the news used to say, of course it is. But nonetheless, she feels cheerful, almost giggly, as if she's a little drunk, as if they're just going on a picnic. It must be a surge of adrenaline. The eastern horizon is brightening. Mist rises from the trees. Dew shimmers on the lumerose bushes, mirroring the faint, eerie light of their flowers. The sweetness of the damp meadow breathes all around them. The birds are beginning to stir and chirp. The vultures on the bare branches are spreading their wings to dry. A peagrit flaps toward them from the south, sails over the meadow, then swoops in for a landing on the edge of the green-scummed swimming pool. It occurs to Toby that she may never see this vista again. Amazing how the heart clutches at anything familiar, whimpering, "Mine, mine." Did she enjoy her enforced stay in the Anuyu spa? No. But it's her home territory now. She's left her skin flakes all over it. A mouse would understand it's her nest. Farewell is the song time sings, Adam One used to say. Somewhere, dogs are barking. She's heard them at intervals over the past months, but today they sound closer. She doesn't much like this. With nobody to feed them, any dogs left by now are sure to have turned wild. She'd climbed up to the rooftop before they left scanned the fields. No pigs, no mohairs, no liobams, or none in plain view.
How little I've ever been able to see, she thinks.
The meadow, the driveway, the swimming pool, the garden, the edge of the forest. She'd like to avoid going in there, among the trees.
Nature may be dumb as a sack of hammers, Zeb used to say, but it's smarter than you.
Look, she thinks of the forest, with its hidden pigs and liobams, and painballers too, for all she knows. Don't push me. I may be pink, but I've got a rifle. Bullets too. Longer range than a spray gun. So back off, assholes. The spa grounds and its woodland perimeter are separated from the surrounding heritage park by a chain-link fence topped with electrified barbed wire, though the electricity won't be functional now. Four gates, east, west, north, and south, with winding driveways connecting them. It's Toby's plan to spend the night at the eastern gatehouse. That's not too far for Ren to walk. She's still not strong enough for heroic trekking. The next morning, they can begin to make their way gradually towards the sea. Ren still believes they'll find Amanda. They'll find her, and Toby will shoot the gold painballers with her rifle, and then Shackleton and Crozier and Oates will reappear from wherever they've been hiding. Ren's not yet free of the effects of her illness. She wants Toby to fix and cure everything, as if she herself were still a child, as if Toby were still Eve 6 with magic adult powers. They pass the crashed pink minivan and around a curve in the road to other vehicles, a solar car, a jeep-sized garboyle guzzler. Judging from the blackened wreckage, both must have burned. There's a rusty, sweetish odor mixed in with the charred smell. Don't look inside, Toby tells Ren as they walk past.
It's okay, Ren says. I saw a lot of stuff like that in the plebes when we were coming here from Scales.
Farther along, there's a dog, a spaniel, recently dead. Something's torn it open. There's a scribble of entrails, a buzzing of flies, but no vultures yet. Whatever it was will surely return to its kill. Predators don't waste. Toby eyes the roadside bushes. The vines are growing almost audibly, shutting out sight.
What a lot of kudzu.
We should walk faster, she says. But Ren can't walk faster. She's tired, her pack sack's too heavy.
I think I'm getting a blister, she says.
They stop under a tree for a drink of zizzy fruit. Toby can't shake the feeling that something's crouched up in the branches, waiting to leap on them. Can liobams climb? She forces herself to slow down, to breathe deeply, to take her time. Let's see your blister, she says to Ren. It's not a blister yet. She tears a strip off her top to toe, winds it around Ren's foot. The sun's at 10. They put on their top to toes and Toby smears their faces with more solar nicks, then sprays them again with Super D. Ren begins to limp before they've reached the next curve in the road.
We'll cut across the meadow, says Toby. It's shorter that way.
St. Rachel and All Birds. Year 25. Of the Gifts of St. Rachel and of the Freedom of the Spirit. Spoken by Adam 1.
Dear friends, dear fellow creatures and fellow mortals, what a cause for rejoicing is this rearranged world in which we find ourselves. True, there is a certain, let us not say, disappointment. The debris left by the waterless flood, like that left by any receding flood, is not attractive. It will take time for our longed-for Eden to appear, my friends. But how privileged we are to witness these first precious moments of rebirth. How much clearer the air is now that man-made pollution has ceased. This freshly cleansed air is to our lungs as the air up there in the clouds is to the lungs of birds. How light, how ethereal they must feel as they soar above the trees. For many ages, birds have been linked to the freedom of the spirit as opposed to the heavy burden of matter. Does not the dove symbolize grace, the all-forgiving, the all-accepting? It is in the spirit of that spirit of grace that we welcome among us three fellow mortal companions on our journey, Melinda, Darren, and Quill. They have miraculously escaped the waterless flood by having been providentially sequestered, Melinda on a hilltop yoga and weight loss establishment, Darren in a hospital isolation ward, and Quill in a place of solitary incarceration. We rejoice that these three appear not to have been exposed to viral contamination. Although not of our faith, or not still of our faith in the case of Quill and Melinda, they are our fellow creatures, and we are happy to aid them at this common time of trial. We are grateful also for this temporary abode, which, though it is a former Happy Kappa franchise, has sheltered us from the grilling sun and the grueling storm. Thanks to the skills of Stuart, in especial his acquaintance with chisels, we have gained entrance to the storeroom, thereby procuring access to much Happy Kappa product, the dried milk substitute, the vanilla-flavored syrup, the mochaccino mix, and the single-serving packets of sugar, both raw and white. You all know my view of refined sugar products, but there are times when the rules must bend. Thank you to Nuala, our indomitable Eve Nine, for the skill with which she has whipped up a sustaining brew for our refreshment. We remember on this day that the Happy Kappa Corp. was in direct contravention to the spirit of St. Rachel. Its sun-grown, pesticide-sprayed, rainforest habitat-destroying coffee products were the biggest threat to God's feathered creatures in our times, just as DDT was the biggest threat to them in the times of St. Rachel Carson. It was in the spirit of St. Rachel that some of our more radical former members joined the militant campaign against Happy Kappa. Other groups were protesting its treatment of indigenous workers, but those ex-gardeners were protesting its anti-bird policies. Although we could not condone the violent methods, we did endorse the intention. Saint Rachel dedicated her life to the feathered ones and thus to the welfare of the entire planet, for as the birds sickened and died out, did this not indicate the growing illness of life itself? Imagine God's sorrow as he viewed the distress of his most exquisite and tuneful feathered creations. Saint Rachel was attacked by the powerful chemical corpse of her day and scorned and pilloried for her truth-telling, but her campaign did at last prevail. Sadly, the anti-Happy Kappa campaign did not meet with equal success, but that problem has now been solved by a greater power. Happy Kappa has not survived the waterless flood. As the human words of God put it in Isaiah 34, "From generation to generation it shall lie waste, but the cormorant and the bittern shall possess it. There shall the great owl make her nest and lay and hatch and gather under her shadow. There shall the vultures also be gathered, every one with her mate." And so it has come to pass. Even now, my friends, the rainforest must be regenerating. Let us sing, "When God Shall His Bright Wings Unfold."
Shall his bright wings unfold and fly from heaven's blue? He first will as a dove appear of pure and sparkling hue. The raven's form he'll take to show there's beauty too in any bird he makes, the oldest and the new. He'll sail with swans, with hawks he'll glide, with cockatoo and owl. The chorus of the dawn he'll sing,
He'll dive with the waterfowl.
As vulture next appear, the holy bird of yore, who death does eat and thus does life restore, under his wings will sheltered be. From fowler's nets he'll save. His eye will note the sparrow's fall and mark the eagle's grave, whose avian blood to shed in idle sport and play, to kill God's holy peace that blessed the seventh day. When God shall his bright wings unfold.
Chapter 68. Wren, St. Chico Mendez, Martyr. Year 25. We walk through the shimmering meadow. There's a humming, like a thousand tiny vibrators. Huge pink butterflies float all around. The clover scent is very strong. Toby probes in front of her with her mop handle. I try to pay attention to where I'm putting my feet, but the ground is lumpy and I trip, and when I look down, it's a boot. Beetles scurry out. There's some animals up ahead. They weren't there a minute ago. I wonder if they were lying down in the grass and then stood up. I hang back, but Toby says, "It's okay, they're just mohairs." I've never seen a live one before, only online. They stand there looking at us with their jaws moving sideways. "Would they let me pat them?" I say. They're blue and pink and silver and purple. They look like candy or sunny day clouds, so cheerful and peaceful. "I doubt it," says Toby. "We need to walk faster."
"They're not afraid of us," I say.
"They should be," says Toby. "Come on. Let's go." The mohairs watch us. When we're closer to them, they turn in a group and move slowly away. At first, Toby says we're going to the Eastern Gatehouse. Then after we walk for a while on the paved road, she says it's farther than she thought. I start to feel dizzy because it's so hot, especially inside the top to toe. So Toby says we'll head for the trees at the far side of the meadow, because it will be cooler in there. I don't like the trees. It's too dark in there, but I know we can't stay out in the meadow. It is shadier under the trees, but not cooler. It's dank, and there's no breeze, and the air is thick, as if it has more air stuffed into it than other air does. But at least we're out of the sun, so we take off our top to toes and walk along the pathway. There's that rich, deep smell of rotting wood, the mushroomy smell I remember from the gardeners when we'd go to the park for St. Yule's. The vines have been moving in over the gravel, but a lot of the branches are broken back and stepped on, and Toby says that someone else has come this way. Not today, though, because the leaves have wilted. There's crows up ahead, making a racket. We come to a stream with a little bridge. The water's rippling over stones, and I can see minnows in it. On the far bank, there are signs of digging. Toby stands still, turns her head to listen. Then she crosses the bridge and looks at the hole that's been dug. "Gardeners," she says, "or someone smart." The gardeners taught that you should never drink right from a stream, especially one near a city. You should make a hole beside it, so the water would be filtered at least a little. Toby has an empty bottle, the one we've been drinking from. She fills it from the water hole, so only the top layer of water runs into the bottle. She doesn't want any drowned worms. Up ahead, off in a small clearing, there's a patch of mushrooms. Toby says they're sweet tooth, Hydnum rapandum, and they used to be a fall variety when we still had fall. We pick them and Toby puts them into one of the cloth bags she's brought and hangs the bag outside her pack so the mushrooms won't get squashed. Then we continue on. We smell the thing before we see it. "Don't scream," says Toby. This is what the crows have been calling about.
"Oh no,"
I whisper. It's Oates. He's hanging from a tree, twisting slowly. The rope is passed under his arms and knotted at the back. He doesn't have any clothes on except for his socks and shoes. This makes it worse because he's less like a statue that way. His head is thrown back, too far because his throat has been cut. Crows flap around his head, scrabbling for footholds. His blonde hair's all matted. There's a gaping wound in his back, like those on the bodies they used to dump in vacant lots after a kidney theft. But these kidneys wouldn't have been stolen for transplants. "Somebody has a very sharp knife," says Toby. I'm crying now.
"They killed little Odie," I say. "I feel sick."
I crumple down onto the ground. Right now, I don't care if I die here. I don't want to be in a world where they do this to Oates. It's so unfair. I'm gulping air in huge gasps, crying so hard I can barely see. Toby takes hold of my shoulders and pulls me up and shakes me. "Stop that," she says. "We don't have time for it. Now come on." She pushes me ahead of her along the path.
"Can't we at least cut him down?" I manage to say. "And bury him?"
"We'll do that later," says Toby. "But he's not in his body anymore. He's in spirit now."
"Shh.
It's okay." She stops and puts her arms around me and rocks me to and fro, then pushes me gently forward again. "We need to reach the gatehouse before the afternoon thunderstorm," she says, "and the clouds are moving in fast from the south and west."
Chapter 69. Toby, St. Chico Mendez Martyr. Year 25. Toby feels bludgeoned. That was brutal. It was horrifying. But she can't show her feelings to Ren. The gardeners would have encouraged mourning within limits as part of the healing process, but there isn't the space for it now. The storm clouds are yellowy green. The lightning's ferocious. She suspects a twister. "Hurry," she says to Ren, "unless you want to be blown away." For the last 50 meters, they hold hands and run, heads down, into the wind. The gatehouse is retro Tex-Mex with rounded lines and pink adobe-style solar skin. All it lacks is a chapel tower and some bells. Already there's kudzu clambering up the walls. The wrought iron gate is standing open. In the ornamental garden, with its ring of whitewashed stones, "Welcome to a new you," spelled out in petunias, but now invaded by purslane and sow thistles, something has been rooting. The pigs, most likely.
"There's some legs," says Ren. "Over there by the gate."
Her teeth are chattering. She's still in shock. "Legs?" says Toby. She feels affronted. How many demi-bodies does she have to encounter in one day? She goes over to the gate to look. The legs aren't human. They're mohair legs. A complete set of four, just the lower legs, the skinny parts. A little hair still on them, lavender in color. There's a head as well, though not a mohair head. It's the head of a Liobam. The golden fur scruffy, the eye sockets empty and crusted. The tongue's gone as well. Liobam tongue, once an expensive gourmet feature at Rarity. Toby walks back to where Ren stands quivering, hands to her mouth. "They're mohair," she says. "I'll make them into soup with our nice mushrooms."
"Oh, I can't eat anything," says Ren in a doleful voice. He was a boy. I used to carry him around."
The tears are rolling down her cheeks.
"Why did they do that?"
You have to eat, says Toby. It's your duty.
Duty to what, she wonders.
Your body is a gift from God, and you must honor that gift, said Adam 1. But right now she feels no such conviction.
The gatehouse door is open. She looks through the window into the reception area. Nobody. And propels Ren inside. The storm's coming fast. She flicks a light switch. No power. There's the usual bulletproof check-in window, a blank-faced document scanner, the finger scan, and iris cameras. You'd stand there knowing that you had 5 wall-mounted spray guns pointed at your back and controlled from the inside room, where the guards used to slouch. She shines her flashlight through the counter window into the darkness of the inner space. Desks, filing cabinets, trash. Over in the corner, a shape, large enough to be someone. Someone dead. Someone asleep, or, worst case, someone who's heard them coming and is pretending to be a garbage bag. Then, once they're at ease, there'd be some sneaking up and baring of canines, some slashing and rending. The door to the inner room's ajar. She sniffs the air. Mildew, of course. What else? Excrement. Decaying meat. Other noxious undertones. She wishes she had the nose of a dog to sort one smell from another. She pulls the door closed. Then she goes outside, despite the rain and wind, and hauls in the biggest stone from the ornamental flower garden border. Not enough to stop a strong person, but it might slow down someone weak or ill. She doesn't wish to be leapt on from behind by a carnivorous mound of tatters.
Why are you doing that? Says Ren.
Just in case, says Toby. She doesn't elaborate. Ren is shaky enough as it is. One more horror and she could collapse. The full force of the storm hits. A thicker darkness howls around them. Thunder hollows out the air.
In the lightning, Ren's face comes and goes, her eyes closed, her mouth a frightened O. She clutches Toby's arm as if about to topple from a cliff.
After what seems like a long time, the thunder trundles away. Toby goes outside to inspect the mohair legs. Her skin's prickling. Those legs didn't walk there by themselves, and they're still quite fresh. No sign of a fire. Whoever killed the animal didn't cook the rest here. She notes the cut marks. Mr. Sharpknife has passed this way. How close might he be?
She looks both ways along the road, strewn now with ripped-off leaves. No movement. The sun's back now. Steam rises. Crows in the distance.
She uses her own knife to scrape much of the hairy skin from one of the mohair legs. If she had a large cleaver, she could hack it into pieces small enough for her cooking pot. Finally, she places one end on the top of the step leading up to the gatehouse and the other on the pavement and hits it with a rock. Now there's the problem of a fire. She could spend a long time rummaging among the trees for dry wood and still come up empty-handed.
I need to go through that door, she says to Ren.
Why?
Says Ren weakly. She's huddled in the empty front room.
There's stuff we can burn, says Toby, to make a fire. Now listen. There might be someone in there.
A dead person?
I don't know, says Toby.
I don't want any more dead people,
says Ren fretfully. There may not be much choice about that, thinks Toby. Here's the rifle, she says. This is the trigger. I want you to stand right here. If anyone but me comes out that door, shoot. Don't hit me by mistake, okay? If she herself gets whacked in there, at least Ren will have a weapon.
Okay,
says Ren. She takes the rifle awkwardly.
But I don't like it.
This is crazy, Toby thinks. She's jumpy enough to shoot me in the back if I sneeze. But if I don't check that room out, no sleep tonight, and maybe a slit throat in the morning. And no fire. She goes in with her flashlight and her mop handle. Papers litter the floor, smashed lamps. There's broken glass crunching underfoot. The smell is stronger now, flies buzzing. The hairs on her arms lift.
The blood rushes in her head. The bundle on the floor is definitely human, covered with some sort of gruesome blanket. Now she can see the dome of a bald head, some wisps of hair. She pokes at the blanket with the mop handle, keeping the beam of light on the bundle. A moan. She pokes again, harder. There's a feeble twitching of cloth. Now there are the slits of eyes and a mouth, lips crusted and blistered.
"Fucking hell," says the mouth. "Who in fuck are you?"
"Are you sick?" says Toby.
"Asshole shot me," says the man.
His eyes are blinking in the light.
"Turn that fucking thing off."
No sign of blood leaking out of his nose or mouth or eyes. With any luck, he doesn't have the plague. "Shot you where?" says Toby. "The bullet must have been hers, from that time in the meadow." A hand scrabbles forth. Red and blue veins. Although he's shriveled and filthy, his eyes sunken with fever, this is Blanco, no doubt of it. She ought to know. She's had the close-up view.
"Leg," he says. "Went bad on me. Fuckers dumped me here."
"Two of them?" says Toby. "Did they have a woman with them?" She makes her voice level.
"Give me some water," says Blanco.
There's an empty bottle in the corner near his head. Two bottles, three. Gnawed ribs. The lavender mohair.
"Who else is out there?"
he rasps, his breaths coming hard.
"More bitches. I heard more."
"Let me see your leg," says Toby. "I may be able to help." He won't be the first person ever to have shammed injury.
"I'm fucking dying," says Blanco. "Turn off that light."
Toby sees various courses of action rippling across his forehead in waves of little frowns. Does he know who she is? Will he try to jump her? "Take the blanket off," says Toby, "and I'll get you some water."
"Take it off yourself," croaks Blanco.
"No," says Toby. "If you don't want help, I'll just lock you in."
"Lock's broken," he says. "Asshole skinny bitch, give me some water."
Toby pinpoints the other smell. Whatever else is wrong with him, he's decaying. "I've got a zizzy fruit," she says. "You'll like that better." She backs out through the door and closes it behind her. But not before Ren had a look. "It's him," she whispers. "The third one, the worst one."
"Take a deep breath," says Toby. "You're perfectly safe. You've got the rifle, he doesn't. Just keep it pointed at that door."
She digs into her pack sack, finds the remaining zizzy fruit, drinks a quarter of the warm, sugary, fizzy liquid. Waste not. Then she fills the bottle up with poppy and adds a generous dollop of powdered amanitas for good measure. The white death angel, granter of dark wishes. "If there's two bad choices, take the lesser evil," Zeb would say. She pushes the door open with her mop handle and shines the flashlight in. Sure enough, Blanco is shoving himself across the floor, grinning with the effort. In one hand is his knife. Most likely he was hoping to get near enough so he could grab her by the ankles when she went in, take her down with him, or use her as a bargaining chip to get hold of Ren. Mad dogs bite. What else is there to know? "Here you are," she says. She rolls the bottle towards him. His knife falls with a clink as he grabs for the bottle, unscrews it with shaking hands, guzzles. Toby waits to make sure it all goes down. "Now you'll feel better," she says gently. She closes the door.
"He'll get out," says Ren. She's ashen.
"If he gets out, we'll shoot him," says Toby. "I've given him some painkillers to calm him down." Silently, she says the words of apology and release, the same as she would for a beetle. She waits until the poppy has taken hold, then re-enters the room. Blanco's snoring heavily. If the poppy doesn't finish him, the death angels will. She lifts the blanket. His left thigh is a mess, decaying cloth and decaying flesh all simmering together. It takes a lot of self-restraint for her not to throw up. Then she sorts through the room for flammables, gathering what she can,
paper, some remnants of a smashed chair, a stack of CDs. There's a second floor, but Blanco's blocking the door to what must be the stairway, and she's not ready to get that close to him yet. She searches under the trees for dead branches, with the barbecue lighter and the paper and the CDs. They catch eventually. She makes bone soup with the mohair leg, adding the mushrooms and some purslane from the flower bed. They eat it sitting in the smoke of the fire because of the mosquitoes. They sleep on the flat roof, using a tree to climb up. Toby drags the pack sacks up too, and the other three mohair legs so nothing can steal them during the night. The rooftop's pebbly and wet as well. They lie on the two sheets of plastic. The stars are brighter than bright. The moon's invisible. Just before they go to sleep, Ren whispers, "What if he wakes up?" "He'll never wake up," says Toby. "Oh," says Ren in a tiny voice. Is that admiration of Toby or simply awe in the face of death? He wouldn't have lived, Toby tells herself, not with a leg as bad as that. Attempting to treat it would have been a waste of maggots. Still, she's just committed a murder. Or an act of mercy. At least he didn't die thirsty. "Don't kid yourself, babe," says the voice of Zeb in her head. "You had vengeance in mind." "May his spirit go in peace," she says out loud. "Such as it is, the fuck pig." Chapter 70. Toby, St. Rachel and All Birds. Year 25. Toby wakes just before dawn. In the distance, there's a liobam, its odd, plaintive roar. Dogs barking. She moves her arms, then her legs. She's stiff as a slab of cement. The dampness of the mist goes right into the marrow. Here comes the sun, a hot rose lifting out of peach-colored clouds. The leaves on the overhanging trees are covered with tiny droplets that shine in the strengthening pink light. Everything looks so fresh, as if newly created. The stones on the rooftop, the trees, the spider webbing slung from branch to branch. Sleeping Wren seems luminous, as if silvered all over. With the pink top-to-toe tucked around her oval face and the mist beading her long eyelashes, she's frail and otherworldly, as if made of snow. The light hits Wren directly, and her eyes open.
Oh shit, she says. I'm late, what time is it?
You're not late for anything, says Toby, and for some reason both of them laugh. Toby scouts with the binoculars. To the east, where they'll be going, there's no movement. But to the west, there's a group of pigs, the biggest gathering of them she's seen to date. 6 adults, 2 young. They're strung out along the roadside like round flesh pearls on a necklace. They have their snouts down, snuffling along as if they're tracking. Tracking us, thinks Toby. Maybe they're the same pigs. The grudge-bearing pigs. The funeral-holding pigs. She stands up, waves the rifle in the air, shouts at them,
"Go away! Piss off!"
At first, they just stare. But when she brings the rifle down and aims it at them, they lollop off into the trees.
It's almost like they know what a rifle is, says Wren.
She's a lot steadier this morning, stronger. Oh, they know, says Toby. They clamber down the tree, and Toby lights the Kelly kettle. Although there's no sign of anyone around, she doesn't want to risk making a bigger fire. She's worried about the smoke. Will anyone smell it? Zeb's rule was, animals shun fire, humans are drawn to it. Once the water has boiled, she makes tea, then she parboils more of the purslane. That will warm them up enough for their early walking. Later, they can have more mohair soup from the 3 legs remaining. Before they leave, Toby checks the gatehouse room. Blanco's cold. He smells even worse, if that's possible. She rolls him onto the blanket and drags him out to the rooted-up earth of the flower bed. Then she finds his knife on the floor where he dropped it. It's sharp as a razor. With it, She slits his filthy shirt up the front. Hairy fish belly. If she was being thorough, she'd open him up. The vultures would thank her. But she remembers the sickening reek of innards from the dead boar. The pigs will take care of it. Maybe they'll view Blanco as an atonement offering to them and forgive her for shooting their fellow pig. She leaves the knife among the flowers. Good tool, but bad karma. She heaves the wrought iron gate shut behind them, the electronic locks non-functional, so she uses some of her rope to tie it shut. If the pigs decide to follow, the gate won't deter them for long. They can dig under, but it may give them pause. Now she and Ren are outside the Inuyu grounds, walking along the weed-bordered road that leads through the heritage park. They come to some picnic table clearings. The kudzu is crawling over the trash barrels and barbecues, the tables and benches. In the sunlight, which is hotter by the minute, butterflies waft and spiral. Toby takes her bearings. Downhill to the east must be the shore, and then the sea. To the southwest, the arboretum, with the creek where the gardener children used to launch their miniature arcs. The road leading to the solar space entrance ought to join in somewhere around here. Nearby is where they'd buried Pilar. Sure enough, there's her elderberry, quite tall now, and in flower. Bees buzz around it. Dear Pilar, thinks Toby, if you were here today, you'd have something wise to tell us. What would it be? Up ahead, they hear bleeding. And 14 mohairs scramble up the bank and out onto the road. Silver, blue, purple, black, a red one with its hair in many braids. And now there's a man. A man in a white bedsheet belted around the waist. It's a biblical getup. He even has a long staff for sheep prodding, no doubt. When he sees them, he stops and turns, watching them quietly. He's got sunglasses on. He's also got a spray gun. He holds it casually by his side, but lets it be clearly seen. The sun's behind him. Toby stands still, her scalp and arms tingling. Is this one of the painballers? He'd turn her into a sieve before she could even get the rifle aimed. The sun's in his favor.
It's Croge, says Ren.
She runs towards him with her arms outstretched, and Toby certainly hopes she's right. But she must be, because the man lets her throw her arms around him. He drops his spray gun and his staff on the ground and clutches Ren tightly, while the mohairs amble about munching flowers.
Chapter 71. Ren, Saint Rachel and All Birds. Year 25.
Croge, I say. I can't believe it. I thought you were dead.
I'm talking into his bedsheet because we're holding on so tight I'm smushed up against him. He doesn't say anything. Maybe he's crying. So I say, I bet you thought I was dead too. And I feel him nod. I let go and we look at each other. He tries a grin.
Where'd you get the bedsheet?
I say.
There's a lot of beds around, he says. These things are better than pants. You don't get so hot.
Did you see Oates? He sounds worried. I don't know what to say. I don't want to spoil this time by telling him about something so unhappy. Poor Oates hanging in a tree with his throat cut and his kidneys missing. But then I look at his face and realize I've misunderstood. It's me he's worried about, because he already knows about Oates. He and Shaki were up ahead of us on the path. They'd have heard me shout. They'd have hidden. Then they would have heard the screaming, all sorts of screaming. Then later, because of course they would have come back to check, they would have heard the crows. If I say no, he'll most likely pretend that Oates is still alive, so as not to upset me.
Yes, I say. We did see him. I'm sorry.
He looks at the ground. I think of how I can change the subject. The mohairs have been nibbling all around us. They want to stay close to Croge, so I say, "Are those your sheep?" "We've started herding them," he says. "We've got them kind of tamed, but they keep getting out." "Who is we?" I'd like to ask. But Toby comes up, so I say, "This is Toby. Remember?" And Croge says, "No shit, from the gardeners?" Toby gives him one of her dry little nods and says, "Crozier, you've certainly grown," as if it's a school reunion. It's hard to throw her off balance. She sticks out her hand, and Croge shakes it. It's so strange, Croge in a bedsheet, looking like Jesus, though his beard isn't exactly flowing, and Toby and me in our pink outfits, with the winking eyes and lipstick mouths, and Toby, with three purple mohair legs sticking up out of her pack sack. "Where's Amanda?" he says. "She's not dead," I say too quickly. "I just know she isn't." He and Toby trade a look over my head, as if they don't want to tell me my pet bunny got run over. "What about Shackleton?" I say, and Croge says, "He's okay. Let's go back to the place." "What place?" says Toby, and he says, "The Cobb House, where we used to have the Tree of Life exchange, remember?" he says to me. "It's not too far." The sheep are heading that way anyway. They seem to know where they're going. We follow along behind them. The sun's so hot by now that it's boiling inside our top to toes. Croge has part of his bedsheet draped over his head. He looks a lot cooler than me. It's noon when we reach the old Tree of Life parquet. The plastic swings are gone, but the Cobb House is the same. Even the spray-painted plebe tags are there, except they've been building onto it. There's a fence made of poles and planks and wire and a lot of duct tape. Croge opens the gate, and the sheep go in and file towards a pen in the yard. "I got the sheep," Croge calls, and a man with a spray gun comes out through the house door, and then two more men, then four women, two young, one a bit older, and an older one, maybe as old as Toby. Their clothes aren't gardener clothes, but they aren't new, and they aren't pretty. Two of the men are wearing bedsheets, the third has cutoffs and a shirt. The women have long cover-ups like top-to-toes. They stare at us. Not friendly, anxious. Croge says our names. "You sure they're not infected?" says the first man, the one with the spray gun. "No way," says Croge. "They were isolated the whole time." He looks at us for confirmation, and Toby nods. "Friends of Zeb," Croge adds. "Toby and Ren." Then he tells us, "This is Mad Adam." "What's left of us?" says the shortest man. He says their names. His is Beluga, and the other three are Ivory Bill, Manatee, and Zunzuncito. The women are Lotus Blue, Swift Fox, White Sedge, and Tamarow. We don't shake hands. They're still nervous about us and our germs. "Mad Adam," says Toby. "Good to meet you. I followed some of your work online." "How did you get in?" Ivory Bill says to Toby. "To the playroom." He's eyeing her antique rifle as if it's made of gold. "I was inaccessible rail," says Toby. They look at one another. "You?" says Lotus Blue. "You were inaccessible. The secret lady," she laughs. "Zeb would never tell us who you were. We thought you were some hot bimbo he had." Toby gives her a thin little smile. "He said you were solid, though," says Tamarow. "He insisted on that." "Zeb," says Toby, as if she's talking to herself. I know she wants to ask if he's still alive, but she's afraid to. Mad Adam was a great caper, says Beluga, until we got snatched. So-called drafted by fucking rejuve, says White Sedge, the youngest woman. Crake that little bastard. She's brown-skinned, but she has kind of an English accent, so it comes out bastard. They're a lot friendlier now that Toby's told them she was really somebody else. I'm confused. I look up at Croge, and he says, "It was that thing we were doing, the bioresistance thing. Why they put us in painball. These are the scientists they scooped. Remember I told you? At Scales?" "Oh," I say, but I'm still not clear. Why did Rejuve scoop them? Was it a brain kidnapping like what happened to my father? "We had visitors," Ivory Bill says to Croge, "after you went for the sheep. Two guys with a woman and a spray gun and a dead rack hunk." "Really?" says Croge. "That's major." "Said they were painball, like we should respect that," says Beluga. "They wanted to trade the woman for spray gun cells and mohair meat. The woman and the rack hunk." "I bet it was them got our purple mohair," says Croge. "Toby found the legs."
"Rack hunk? Why would we trade for that?" says White Sedge indignantly. "We're not starving."
"We should have shot them," says Manatee. "But they were holding the woman in front."
"What was she wearing?" I say, but they ignore me.
"We said no trade," says Ivory Bill. "Tough for the girl, but they're desperate for cells, which means they're running out, so we'll deal with them later."
"It's Amanda," I say. They could have saved her, though I don't blame them for not trading. You can't give spray cells to guys who'll use them to kill you. "What about Amanda?" I say. "Shouldn't we go and get her?"
"Yeah, we need to get everyone together now that the flood's over," says Croge. "Like we've said."
He's backing me up. "Then we can, you know, rebuild the human race," I say. I know it sounds stupid, but it's the only thing I can think of.
Amanda could really help us. She's so good at everything.
But they just smile at me sadly, as if they know it's hopeless. Croge takes my hand and walks me away from them.
"You mean that?" he says. "About the human race?"
He smiles.
"You'll have to have babies."
"Maybe not just yet," I say.
"Come on," he says. "I'll show you the garden."
They have a cookhouse and some violet portabiolets over in one corner and some solar they're fixing up. There's no shortage of parts for just about everything back in the plebes, though you have to look out for falling buildings. Their vegetable garden is in behind. They don't have a lot of stuff planted yet.
"We get pig attacks," he says. "They dig under the fence. We shot one of them, so maybe the others got the point. Zeb says they're super pigs because they're spliced with human brain tissue."
"Zeb?" I say. "Is Zeb alive?" I feel dizzy all of a sudden. All of these dead people coming alive again. It's overwhelming.
"Sure," says Croge. "Are you all right?"
He puts his arm around me to keep me from falling down.
Chapter 72. Toby, St. Rachel and All Birds. Year 25. Wren and Crozier have wandered off behind the Cobb house. No harm, thinks Toby. Young love, no doubt. She's telling Ivory Bill about the third man, the dead one, Blanco. He listens carefully. "Plague?" he asks. "An infected bullet wound," she says. She doesn't add the poppy and the death angels. While they're talking, another woman comes around from behind the house.
"Hey, Toby," she says. "It's Rebecca. Older, less plump, but still Rebecca. Solid." She takes hold of Toby's shoulders. "You're too thin, sweetheart," she says. "Never mind. We've got bacon. Fatten you up for sure."
Bacon is not a concept that Toby can grasp right now.
Rebecca, she says. She wants to add, why are you alive? But this is, increasingly, a meaningless question. Why are any of them alive? So she merely says, wonderful.
Zeb said you'd make it. He always said that. Hey, give me a smile.
Toby doesn't like the past tense. It has a deathbed smell.
When did he say it? She asks.
Heck, he says it most days. Now come on in the kitchen, eat something. Tell me where you've been.
Zeb's alive then, thinks Toby. Now that it's true, she feels she's always known it. She also doubts it. It won't really be true until she sees him, touches him. They have coffee, dandelion roots roasted, Rebecca says proudly, and some baked burdock root with herbs and a slice of, could it be cold pork?
Those pigs are a nuisance, says Rebecca. Too smart by half.
She eyes Toby challengingly.
Needs must when the devil drives, she says. Anyways, at least we know what's in it. Not like it's secret burgers.
It's delicious, Toby says, truthfully. After their snack, Toby hands over the three remaining mohair legs, not that fresh, but Rebecca says they'll be fine for stock. Then they plunge right into history. Toby runs through her time in the Anuyu Spa and tells about the arrival of Ren. Rebecca describes her fake identity selling life insurance in gated communities out west while planting Mad Adam's inventive bioforms and how she got the last bullet train east. A risk, lot of folks coughing, but she wore a nose cone and gloves, and then holed up in the wellness clinic, along with Zeb and Katuro.
In our old meeting room, remember, she says, our Ararat supplies were still there.
And Katuro, says Toby.
Doing fine. Had a germ of some kind, but not the bad one. He's over it now. He's off with Zeb and Shackleton and Black Rhino. They're looking for Adam One and the rest of them. Zeb says if anyone could get through, they could.
Really? There's a chance, says Toby.
Did he look for me? She wants to ask.
Probably not.
He'd have thought she'd do fine on her own.
And she had, hadn't she? We've been listening on the wind-up shortwave 24/7 and sending, too. Couple of days ago, we finally got an answer, says Rebecca.
It was him? Toby's prepared to believe anything now. Adam One?
We just heard the one voice. All it said was, I'm here. I'm here.
Let's hope, says Toby.
And she does hope. Or she tries to. There's the barking of dogs outside and a confusion of shouting.
Shit, dog attack, says Rebecca. Bring that gun.
The Mad Adams with spray guns are already at the fence. Big dogs and small ones, maybe 15, bounding towards them, wagging their tails. The spray gunners begin shooting. Before Toby can fire, 7 of the dogs are dead and the rest have run away.
Watson Crick splices, says Ivory Bill. They're not really dogs, they only look like it. They'll tear out your throat. Use them in prison moats and such. You couldn't hack them, not like an alarm system code. But they got loose during the flood.
Are they breeding? Says Toby.
Will they have to fight off wave after wave of these non-dogs, or are they few in number?
Lord knows, says Ivory Bill.
Lotus Blue and White Sedge go out to make sure the dogs are dead. Then Tamarau and Swift Fox and Rebecca and Toby join them, and they skin and butcher, with the spray gunners standing guard in case the other dogs come back. Toby's hands remember how to do this from long ago. The smell is the same, too, a childhood smell. The dog skins are laid aside. The meat's cut up and put into a pot. Toby feels a little sick, but she also feels hungry.
Chapter 73. Wren, St. Rachel and All Birds. Year 25. I ask Croge if I should be helping to skin the dogs, but Croge says there's enough people doing it and I look tired, so why don't I lie down on his bed inside the Cobb house? The room is cool, and smells the cobhouse way I remember, so I feel safe. Crozier's bed is just a platform, but it has a silver mohair fleece on it with a sheet. And Crozier says, "Sleep tight," and then goes away. And I take off my Anuyu top and pants because it's getting too hot, and the mohair is soft and silky, and I go to sleep. When the afternoon thunderstorm wakes me up, Crozier's curled around behind me, and I can tell he's worried and sad. So I turn around, and then we're hugging each other, and he wants to have sex. But all of a sudden, I don't want to have sex without loving the person. And I haven't really loved anybody in that way since Jimmy, certainly not at Scales where it was just acting with other people's kinky scripts. Also, there's a dark place in me, like ink spilled into my brain. I can't think about sex in that place. It has brambles in it, and something about Amanda, and I don't want to be there. So I say, "Not yet." And even though Crows used to be kind of crude, he seems to understand. So we just hold on to each other and talk. He's full of plans. They'll build this, they'll build that. They'll get rid of the pigs or else tame them. After the two painballers are dead, he personally will take care of that. He'll take me and Amanda and Shaki too, and we'll all go down to the beach and do some fishing. As for the Mad Adam group, Bill and Sedge and Tamarau and Rhino, all them, they're really smart, so they'll have the communications going in no time.